hanging from his neck, had evidently long been waiting. Two clerks sat at their tables writing, and the sound of their pens was audible. The writing-table accessories, of which Karenin was a connoisseur, were unusually good, as he could not help noticing. One of the clerks, without rising from his chair, screwed up his eyes and addressed Karenin ill-humouredly.
"What do you want?"
"I want to see the lawyer on business."
"The lawyer is engaged,"
replied the assistant sternly, and indicated with his pen the persons who were waiting.
"Can he not find time to see me?" said Karenin.
"He has no spare time. He is always busy. Be so kind as to wait."
"Then I will trouble you to give him my card,"
said Karenin with dignity, seeing the impossibility of preserving his incognito. The assistant took the card, and though he evidently did not approve of what he read on it, went out of the room. Karenin approved in theory of public trial, but for certain high official reasons he did not quite sympathize with some aspects of its application in Russia, and he condemned these applications as far as he could condemn anything that had been confirmed by the emperor. His whole life had been spent in administrative activity, and therefore when he disapproved of anything, his disapproval was mitigated by a recognition of the inevitability of mistakes and the possibility of improvement in everything. In the new legal institutions, he disapproved of the position occupied by lawyers. But till now, he had never had to deal with a lawyer, and so had disapproved only in theory. Now his disapproval was strengthened by the unpleasant impression he received in the lawyer's waiting room.
"He will be here in a moment," said the assistant. And in fact, a minute or two later, in the doorway appeared the long figure of an elderly jurisconsult who had been conferring with the lawyer, followed by the lawyer himself. The lawyer was a short, thick-set, bald-headed man with a black beard tinged with red, long, light-coloured eyebrows, and a bulging forehead. He was as spruce as a bridegroom, from his white necktie and double watch-chain to his patent leather boots. His face was intelligent and peasant-like, but his dress was dandified and in bad taste.
"Come in, please," said the lawyer to Karenin, and gloomily ushering his client in before him, he closed the door.
"Won't you take a seat?"
He pointed to a chair beside a writing-table covered with papers, and himself took the principal seat, rubbing his little hands with their short fingers covered with white hair and bending his head to one side. But hardly had he settled down when a moth flew across the table. The lawyer, with a rapidity one could not have expected of him, separated his hands, caught the moth, and resumed his former position.
"Before I begin speaking of my case," said Karenin, who had followed the lawyer's movements with astonishment, "I must mention that the business about which I have to speak to you must be strictly private."
A scarcely perceptible smile moved the lawyer's drooping, reddish moustache.
"I should not be a lawyer if I could not keep the secrets entrusted to me. But if you would like a confirmation..."
Karenin glanced at him and saw that his intelligent grey eyes were laughing, as if he knew everything in advance.
"You know my name?" continued Karenin.
"I know you, and like every Russian, I know..."
Here he again caught a moth.
"Your useful activity," said the lawyer, bowing.
Karenin sighed, collecting his courage, but having once made up his mind, he went on in his squeaky voice without timidity or hesitation, emphasizing a word here and there.
"I have the misfortune," began Karenin, "to be a deceived husband, and I wish legally to break off relations with my wife, that is, to be divorced, but in such a way that my son should not remain with his mother."
The lawyer's grey eyes tried not to laugh, but they danced with irrepressible glee, and Karenin saw that it was not only the glee of a man getting profitable business, there was triumph and delight, and a gleam resembling the evil boding gleam he had seen in his wife's eyes.
"You want my assistance to obtain a divorce?"
"Just so. But I must warn you that there is a risk that I may be wasting your time.
I have come only for a preliminary consultation.
I wish for a divorce, but the form in which it can be obtained is of importance to me.
It is quite possible that if the forms do not coincide with my requirements, I shall forego my legitimate desire.
Oh, that is always so, said the lawyer. That is always open to you.
The lawyer looked down at Karenin's feet, feeling that the sight of his irrepressible joy might offend his client. He glanced at a moth that flew past his nose, and his hand moved, but did not catch it, out of respect for Karenin's situation.
Although the general outline of our laws relating to this matter is known to me, continued Karenin, I should like to know the forms in which such cases are conducted in practice.
You wish me to state, the lawyer said, still not raising his eyes, and adopting with a certain pleasure his client's manner of speech,
the various methods by which your desire can be carried out?
And on Karenin's nodding affirmatively, the lawyer continued, only occasionally casting a glance at Karenin's face, which had grown red in patches.
Divorce under our laws, he said, with a slight shade of disapproval of the laws, as you are aware, may be granted in the following cases.
You must wait,
he exclaimed, addressing his assistant, who had looked in at the door. But he rose all the same, spoke a few words to his assistant, and sat down again.
In the following cases, physical defect in husband or wife, 5 years absence without news, and he bent one of his short, hairy fingers, and in cases of adultery, he uttered the word with evident pleasure. These are subdivided as follows. And he went on, bending down his thick fingers, though the cases and the subdivisions evidently could not be classed together. Physical defects in husband or in wife, and adultery of husband or of wife. As all his fingers had been used, he straightened them all out, and continued, "That is the theoretical view, but I suppose you've done me the honour of applying to me in order to learn the practical application of the law. Therefore, guided by the precedents, I have to inform you that cases of divorce all come to the following. There is, I suppose, no physical defect or absence without news."
Karenin nodded affirmatively.
"Come to the following. Adultery of husband or wife, and the detection of the guilty party by mutual consent, or involuntary detection without such consent. I must add that the latter case is seldom met with in practice."
And with a momentary glance at Karenin, the lawyer became suddenly silent, like a man who, when selling pistols, has described the advantages of the different kinds and waits for his customer's decision. But Karenin remained silent, and so he began again.
"The most usual, simple, and reasonable way I consider to be adultery by mutual consent. I should not venture so to express myself were I talking to a man of undeveloped mind," said the lawyer, "but I expect it is comprehensible to you."
Karenin was, however, so much upset that he did not at once understand the reasonableness of adultery by mutual consent, and his perplexity was expressed in his looks. But the lawyer immediately helped him.
"Two people can no longer live together. There is the fact. And if both agree about that, the details and formalities become unimportant, and at the same time it is the simplest and surest method."
Karenin quite understood now. But he had religious requirements which hindered his acceptance of this method.
"It is out of the question in the present case," said he. "Only one measure is possible. Involuntary detection confirmed by letters, which I have."
At the mention of letters, the lawyer pressed his lips together and gave vent to a high-pitched sound of pity and contempt.
"Please remember that cases of this kind, as you know, are decided by the ecclesiastical department, and the reverend fathers in such cases are keenly interested in the minutest details," he said, with a smile that showed his fellow feeling with the reverend father's taste.
"Letters may certainly serve as a partial confirmation,
But direct evidence from witnesses must be produced. In general, if you do me the honour to entrust the case to me, leave me to choose the means which should be used. He who desires a result accepts the means of obtaining it.
If it is so, Karenin began, growing suddenly pale. But at that moment the other suddenly rose and went to the door to speak to his assistant, who had again come to interrupt him.
"Tell her we have not got a cheap sale on here," he said, and came back again.
As he was returning, he furtively caught another moth.
"A fine state my furniture will be in when summer comes," he thought, and frowned.
"Yes, you were saying?"
he began.
"I will write and let you know what I decide," said Karenin, rising and holding on by the table. After a short pause, he said, "I may conclude from your words that a divorce could be obtained. I would also ask you to let me know your terms."
"It is quite possible, if you allow me full liberty of action," said the lawyer, without taking any notice of the last question.
"When may I expect to hear from you?" he added, moving toward the door, his eyes and patent leather boots shining.
"In a week's time. And you will be so good as to let me know whether you are willing to undertake the case, and on what terms?"
"Very well."
The lawyer bowed deferentially, let his client pass out, and being left alone, abandoned himself to his happy mood. He felt so cheerful that, contrary to his custom, he allowed a reduction to the bargaining lady, and gave up catching moths, having made up his mind to have his furniture recovered next winter with velvet, like Sigonin's. Chapter 6 Karenin had gained a brilliant victory at the committee meeting of the 17th of August, but the consequence of that victory undermined his power. The new committee for investigating the conditions of the subject races from every point of view had been formed and sent to its field of action with unusual promptitude and energy stirred up by Karenin. 3 months later, the committee sent in its report. The subject races' conditions had been investigated from the political, administrative, economic, ethnographical, material, and religious points of view. All the questions had received splendidly drafted answers, answers not open to doubt since they were not the result of human thoughts, always liable to error, but were the outcome of official labours. All the answers were based on official data, reports from governors and bishops based on reports from district authorities and ecclesiastical superintendents, based in their turn on reports from rural administrative officers and parish priests. Therefore, these answers could not admit of any doubt. All the questions as to why they had bad harvests, for instance, or why the natives kept to their own creeds and so on, questions which, without the convenience of the official machine, don't get solved and can't get solved for centuries, had received clear and certain solutions. And the solutions arrived at were in accord with Karenin's opinions. But Stremov, who had been touched to the quick at the last meeting, made use of tactics for which Karenin was not prepared. Stremov suddenly changed over to Karenin's side, bringing several other members in his train, and not only warmly supported the measures advocated by Karenin, but proposed other, more extreme measures of the same nature. These measures, going beyond Karenin's original idea, were accepted, and then Stremov's tactics became manifest. The measures, carried to extremes, proved so stupid that persons in office, public opinion, intellectual women, and the press, all at the same moment, fell upon them, expressing indignation at the measures themselves, and at Karenin, their acknowledged originator. Stremov stood aside, pretending to have blindly followed Karenin's plans, and to be himself indignant now at what had been done, thus undermining Karenin. But in spite of failing health and family troubles, Karenin did not give in. There was a split in the committee.
some of the members, with Stremov at their head, excused their mistake by maintaining that they had put their faith in the report presented by the revisory committee directed by Karenin, and said that that committee's report was nonsense and nothing but waste paper. Karenin and a number of others saw danger in so revolutionary an attitude toward official documents, and continued to support the data presented by the committee. In consequence, the higher circles and even society became quite confused, and, though everybody was deeply interested in the question, no one could make out whether the subject races were really suffering and perishing or were flourishing. Karenin's position, partly in consequence of this, and partly from the contempt that fell on him as a result of his wife's infidelity, became very shaky. In these circumstances, he took an important resolution. He announced, to the surprise of the committee, that he would ask to be allowed to go and investigate the matter himself, and having received permission, he started for the distant provinces. Karenin's departure was much talked about, especially because, just before starting, he formally returned the post fare sufficient to pay for 12 horses all the way to his destination, which had been advanced to him. "I consider it very fine of him," the Princess Betsy said, referring to it in a conversation with Princess Mayakaya. "Why should they pay for post-horses when everybody knows that we now have railways everywhere?" But the Princess Mayakaya did not agree, and was even irritated by Princess Tsverskaya's views. "It is all very well for you to talk, who possess I don't know how many millions," she said, "but I am very glad when my husband goes on inspection tours in summer. It is very good for his health and pleasant for him, and we have an arrangement by which this allowance goes for the hire of a carriage and coachman for me." On his way to the distant province, Karenin stopped 3 days in Moscow. On the day after his arrival, he went to call on the Governor-General. At the crossing of Gazetny Street, where there is always a crowd of carriages and izvozchiks, he suddenly heard someone calling out his name, in such a loud and cheerful voice that he could not help looking round. On the pavement at the corner of the street, in a short, fashionable overcoat and a small, fashionable hat, his teeth gleaming between his smiling red lips, young, gay and beaming, stood Oblonsky, determinedly and insistently shouting and demanding that Karenin should stop. He was holding with one hand the window of a carriage, from which the head of a lady in a velvet bonnet and two little children's heads were leaning out, and was smilingly beckoning with his other hand to his brother-in-law. The lady, too, with a kind smile, waved her hand to Karenin. The lady with the children was Dolly. Karenin did not wish to see anyone in Moscow, and certainly not his wife's brother. He raised his hat and was going on, but Oblonsky told the coachman to stop and ran across the snow.
"What a shame not to have sent word! Been here long? And I went to Deduzho's hotel yesterday and saw Karenin on the board, and it never entered my head that it could be you," said Oblonsky, thrusting his head in at the carriage window. "Else I should have looked you up. I am glad to see you."
And he kicked his feet together to knock off the snow.
"What a shame not to send word!"
"I could not find time. I am very busy," Karenin answered dryly.
"Come and speak to my wife. She is so anxious to see you."
Karenin unfolded the rug he had wrapped round his legs, which were so sensitive to the cold, got out of the carriage, and making his way through the snow, approached Dolly.
"What is the matter, Alexei Alexandrovich? Why do you avoid us in this way?" Dolly smilingly asked.
"I was exceedingly busy." "Very pleased to see you," he said in a tone that expressed clearly that he was very sorry.
"How are you?" "And how is my dear Anna?"
Karenin muttered something and was about to go when Oblonsky stopped him.
"Do you know what we'll do tomorrow? Dolly, ask him to come and dine with us. We shall invite Koznishev and Pestsov so as to let him taste the Moscow intellectuals."
"Yes, do come," said Dolly. "We shall expect you at 5 or 6, just as you like. But how is my dear Anna? It is so long..."
"She is well," replied Karenin, frowning. "I shall be very pleased." And he went back to his carriage.
"Then you will come?" cried Dolly.
Karenin muttered something which Dolly could not catch amid the noise of passing vehicles.
"I shall call tomorrow," shouted Oblonsky to him.
Karenin got into his carriage and sat far back, so as neither to see nor to be seen.
"Queer chap," said Oblonsky to his wife,
and after glancing at his watch, waved his hand in front of his face as a sign of endearment to his wife and children, and walked jauntily away along the pavement.
"Stiva! Stiva!"
Dolly called and blushed. He turned round.
"You know that I must buy coats for Grisha and Tanya. Give me some money."
"Oh, never mind. Tell them I will pay."
And nodding his head to an acquaintance who was driving past, he disappeared round the corner.
Chapter 7 The next day was Sunday. Oblonsky went to the rehearsal of a ballet at the Imperial Theatre and gave to Masha Chubisova, a pretty dancer who, through his patronage, had just obtained an engagement, a coral necklace he had promised her the evening before, and behind the scene, in the midday darkness of the theatre, contrived to kiss her pretty face, which was brightened by his present. Besides giving her the necklace, he wished to make an appointment to meet her after the ballet. Having explained that he could not be there at the beginning of the performance, he promised to come for the last act and take her to supper. From the theatre, Oblonsky went to the market, and himself selected the fish and asparagus for dinner, and at noon he was already at Dusso's hotel, where he had to call on three people who, fortunately for him, had all put up at the same place. These were Lievin, who had only just returned from abroad, a newly appointed superior official who was making a tour of inspection in Moscow, and Karenin, his brother-in-law, whom he wanted to secure for dinner. Oblonsky liked a good dinner, but liked still more giving a dinner party. Not a big affair, but one select in food, drink, and guests. With the programme for that day's dinner, he was very satisfied. There would be perch, brought alive to the kitchen, and asparagus. The pièce de résistance was to consist of a splendid but quite plain joint of roast beef, and the wines would be well chosen. So much for the food and drink. As for the guests, there would be Kitty and Lievin, and, in order that they should not be too conspicuous, a girl cousin and young Shcherbatsky. Here, the pièce de résistance was to consist of Sergei Ivanich Koznishev and Alexei Alexandrovich Karenin. Sergei Ivanich, a Muscovite and a philosopher, and Alexei Alexandrovich, a Petersburger and a practical politician. Besides these, he meant to ask the well-known crank and enthusiast Pestsov, a liberal and a great talker, a musician and historian, and the dearest of 50-year-old boys, who would serve as sauce or condiment to Koznishev and Karenin, while he himself, Oblonsky, would stir them all up and set them by the ears. The second instalment of the forest money had been paid and was not yet all spent. Dolly had been very nice and kind of late, and the thought of his dinner party pleased Oblonsky in every respect. He was in very high spirits. Just two circumstances were not quite satisfactory, but they were drowned in the ocean of kind-hearted joviality which overflowed his heart. These two circumstances were as follows. From the fact that when he had met Karenin in the street the previous day, the latter had treated him with cold stiffness and had not called or even informed them of his arrival, from this, added to the rumour about Anna and Vronsky that had reached him, Oblonsky concluded that all was not as it should be between the husband and wife. This was one of the unpleasant things, while the other was the fact that his new superior, like all new superiors, had the reputation of being a dreadful man who got up at 6 in the morning, worked like a horse, and expected his subordinates to do the same. This superior also had the reputation of having the manners of a bear, and he was reported to hold views diametrically opposed to those of his predecessor, and, till now, of Oblonsky also. On the previous day, Oblonsky had appeared on service business in uniform. The new superior was very pleasant and chatted with him as with an old acquaintance. Therefore, Oblonsky now considered it his duty to call on him in a morning coat. The thought that the new superior might not take this in good part was the second unpleasant circumstance,
But Oblonsky felt instinctively that everything would turn out splendidly.
"After all, they're all human beings, all men, just like us poor sinners," he thought as he entered the hotel. "What is there to be angry and quarrel about?"
Walking down the corridor, with his hat tilted on one side, he said,
"How do you do, Vasily?"
to a servant he knew.
"You've grown whiskers."
"Lievin, number 7, eh? Will you show me the way? And please find out whether Count Anichkin, the new superior, will receive me."
"Yes, sir,"
replied Vasily with a smile.
"It's a long time since you've been here." "I was here yesterday, but came by the other entrance. Is this number 7?
Lievin was standing in the middle of the room beside a peasant from Tver, measuring a fresh bearskin with a yard measure, when Oblonsky entered.
"Ah! Killed it?" cried Oblonsky. "Fine thing! A she-bear! How do you do, Arkhip?"
He shook hands with the peasant and sat down without taking off his overcoat or hat.
"Do take your things off and stay," said Lievin, removing the hat.
"No, I have no time. I've only come in for a moment," replied Oblonsky, throwing open his coat.
Later on, he took it off and stayed for an hour, talking to Lievin about bear hunting and also about personal matters.
"Now, please tell me what you did abroad and where you've been," said Oblonsky, when the peasant had left.
"Well, I stayed in Germany, in Prussia, in France, and in England. Not in the capitals, but in manufacturing centres. I've seen many new things, and I'm glad I went."
"Yes, I know your idea of settling the working-class problem."
"Not at all. In Russia, there cannot be a working-class problem. In Russia, the question turns on the relation between the labourers and the land. They have the same problems there, but with them it is a case of patching up what has already been spoiled. While here..."
Oblonsky listened to Lievin with attention.
"Yes, yes," he said. "Very likely you're right. But I'm glad you're in good spirits and go bear hunting and work and are full of enthusiasms, because Shcherbatsky told me he met you and you were down in the mouth and kept talking about death."
"Well, what of that? I never stop thinking of death," said Lievin. "It really is time for me to die. All those things are mere nonsense. I will tell you frankly, I value my idea and my work immensely, but really, just think. This whole world of ours is only a speck of mildew sprung up on a tiny planet, yet we think we can have something great. Thoughts, actions.
They are all but grains of sand."
"But, my dear fellow, all that is as old as the hills."
"It is old.
But, you know, when you have once grasped it clearly, everything becomes so insignificant.
If you once realize that tomorrow, if not today, you will die and nothing will be left of you, everything becomes insignificant.
I consider my ideas very important, yet they too turn out to be insignificant, and would be even if it were as possible to carry them out as it was to surround this bear.
And so one passes one's life, finding distraction in hunting or in work, merely not to think of death."
Oblonsky listened to Lievin with an affectionate and subtle smile.
"Well, of course.
So now you've come round to my notion. Do you remember how you used to fly at me for seeking enjoyment in life? Do not be so severe, O moralist."
"But, of course, the good in life is..."
Lievin became confused.
"Oh, I don't know. All I know is that we shall all die soon."
"Why soon?
And, you know, life has less charm when one thinks of death, but it is more peaceful."
"On the contrary, it is even brighter toward the end."
"However, I must be going," returned Oblonsky, rising for the 10th time.
"Don't go yet," said Lievin, trying to detain him.
"When shall we meet again?"
"I'm leaving tomorrow."
"Ah, well, I'm a good one. Why, I came on purpose. You must come and dine with us today. Your brother is coming, and my brother-in-law, Karenin."
"Is he here?"
asked Lievin, and was going to inquire about Kitty. He had heard that she went to Petersburg at the beginning of the winter to visit her sister, who had married a diplomatist.
He did not know whether she had returned, but changed his mind and thought, "Whether she comes or not will make no difference."
"Then you will come?"
"Yes, of course."
"Well, then, at 5, and in morning dress."
And Oblonsky got up and went downstairs to call on the new superior. His instinct had not deceived him. The dreadful new superior turned out to be a most affable man. Oblonsky had lunch with him, and sat talking so long that it was going on for 4 when he arrived at Karenin's.
Chapter 8. Karenin, after returning from church, spent the rest of the morning in the hotel. That day he had 2 matters to see to interview a deputation from a subject race which was in Moscow at that time and give them instructions, and to write to the lawyer as he had promised. The interview, though the deputation had been summoned on his initiative, was an affair that presented many difficulties and even dangers, and Karenin was very glad that it chanced to be in Moscow when he was there. The members of the deputation had not the least comprehension of their role or of their duties. They were naively convinced that their business consisted in explaining their needs and the existing state of affairs, and of asking for help from the government. They could decidedly not understand that some of their statements and demands would play into the hands of the hostile party and thereby ruin their case. Karenin had a prolonged tussle with them, and wrote out for them a program which they were not to overstep, and having dismissed them, he wrote 2 letters to Petersburg. One of them contained instructions regarding this deputation. In this matter, his chief helper was the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, who was a specialist in deputations. No one else could so well pilot a deputation or give it a good start. When he had finished with the deputation, Karenin wrote to the lawyer, without the least hesitation, giving him permission to act at his own discretion, and enclosing 3 notes from Vronsky to Anna, which he had found in the writing case he had taken possession of. Having left his home with the intention of never returning to his family, and having seen the lawyer and communicated, though only to that one person, this intention, and particularly after converting this matter of life into an affair of ink and paper, Karenin had grown more and more used to the notion, so that carrying it into effect now seemed to him possible. He was just closing his letter to the lawyer when he heard Oblonsky's voice. Oblonsky was disputing with Karenin's servant and insisting that he should be announced.
"No matter," thought Karenin. "It is even better so. I will tell him about my position with regard to his sister at once, and will explain why I cannot dine at his house."
"Ask the gentleman in," he said in a loud voice, collecting his papers and placing them inside a blotter. "There, you see, you were lying to me. He is at home," came the voice of Oblonsky in answer to the man who had been trying to stop him as he entered the room, taking off his overcoat as he came. "I'm awfully glad I found you in." "Well, I hope," began Oblonsky cheerfully.
"I can't come,"
Karenin, who was standing, said coldly, without offering his visitor a seat. Karenin had expected to enter at once upon the cool relation in which he would henceforth stand toward the brother of the wife against whom he was beginning divorce proceedings, but he had not counted upon the flood of kindliness which overflowed the banks of Oblonsky's soul. Oblonsky opened his clear and shining eyes wide.
"Why can't you? What do you mean?" he demanded in French, quite taken aback. "Oh, no, you have promised, and we are reckoning on you."
"I must tell you that I can't come because the family connection hitherto subsisting between us must now be severed."
"What? I mean, how? Why?" said Oblonsky, smiling.
"Because I am about to take proceedings to divorce your sister, my wife. I was obliged to..." But before Karenin could finish what he was about to say, Oblonsky did something quite unexpected. He uttered an exclamation of dismay and sat down in an easy chair.
"Dear me! Alexei Alexandrovich! What are you talking about?" he cried, a look of pain appearing on his face.
"It is true."
"Oh, forgive me, but I can't...
I can't believe it.
Karenin sat down, conscious that his words had not the effect he had anticipated, that he would be obliged to give an explanation, and that whatever that explanation might be, it would not alter his relation to his brother-in-law. Yes, I am under the painful necessity of applying for a divorce, he continued.
I will tell you just one thing, Alexei Alexandrovich. I know you to be a first-rate and a just man. I know Anna to be, excuse me, I cannot change my opinion of her, a fine, a splendid woman. And therefore, forgive me, but I cannot believe this. There must be some misunderstanding, said Oblonsky.
Ah, if it were only a misunderstanding. Wait a moment. I understand, Oblonsky interrupted him.
But of course.
Only this. One should not be in a hurry.
No, one shouldn't be in a hurry.
I was not in a hurry, replied Karenin coldly. In a case like this, it was impossible to consult anyone. I have quite made up my mind.
But it is awful, said Oblonsky, sighing deeply.
One thing I would do, Alexei Alexandrovich, if I were you.
I entreat you to do it.
You have not yet commenced proceedings, as I understand.
Well, before doing so, see my wife and talk it over with her. She cares for Anna as for a sister. She is fond of you, and she is a wonderful woman. For heaven's sake, talk it over with her. Do me this favor, I entreat you.
Karenin considered, and for a while Oblonsky gazed at him, full of sympathy, without breaking the silence.
You will come and see her?
I hardly know. The reason I did not call on you is that I think our relationship must be altered.
Why? I don't see it. Allow me to believe that beside our family relationship, you share at least to some extent the friendly feeling I have always had for you, and sincere respect, added Oblonsky, pressing the other's hand. Even if your worst suspicions proved correct, I never took upon myself, and never will, to judge either side. And I see no reason why our relations should change. But do, now do come and see my wife.
Ah, we look at the matter differently, said Karenin coldly. However, don't let us talk about it.
But why won't you come? Supposing you came to dinner today. My wife expects you. Do come, and above all, do talk it over with her. She is a wonderful woman. For heaven's sake, I implore you on my bended knees.
If you wish it so much, I will come, said Karenin with a sigh. And anxious to change the subject, he inquired about a matter interesting them both. Oblonsky's new superior, a man who, though still young, had suddenly been given so important a post. Karenin had never liked Count Anichkin. Their opinions had always been at variance, and now he could not repress a feeling of spite quite comprehensible to anyone in an official position toward a more successful man.
Well, and have you seen him? Said Karenin with a venomous smile. Oh, yes, he came to the council yesterday. He seems to know his business perfectly, and is very active.
Yes, but in what direction? Asked Karenin. Toward getting things done, or toward changing what has been done already. The curse of our state is its red tape administration, of which he is a worthy representative.
I really don't know what his tendencies are, but I do know that he's a first-rate fellow, replied Oblonsky. I've just been to see him, and he really is a first-rate chap. We had lunch, and I showed him how to make that stuff, you know, wine with oranges. It's very refreshing, and it is amazing that he did not know of it. He liked it very much. Yes, he certainly is a first-rate chap.
Oblonsky looked at his watch. Dear me, it is getting on for 5, and I have still to call on Dolgovushin.
Well then, do please come to dinner. You have no idea how grieved I and my wife will be if you don't.
Karenin parted from his brother-in-law in a very different manner to that in which he had met him. I have promised, and I will come, he answered. In a dejected tone.
Believe me, I appreciate it, and hope that you will not repent it, Oblonsky replied, smiling.
As he put on his overcoat while walking away, His arm struck the servant's head. He laughed and went out. 5 o'clock, and morning dress, if you please, he sang out, returning to the door. Chapter 9. It was past 5, and some of the visitors had already arrived when the master of the house came home. He entered together with Sergei Ivanich Koznishev and Pestsov, who had met on the doorstep. These two were the chief representatives of the Moscow intellectuals, as Oblonsky called them. Both were men respected for their characters and abilities. They respected one another, but in almost everything they were completely and hopelessly at variance, not because they belonged to different schools of thought, but just because they belonged to one camp. Their enemies confused them one with the other, and in that camp each of them had his own shade. And as there is nothing less amenable to agreement than disagreement on semi-abstract themes, they not only disagreed in their opinions, but had long been accustomed without anger to ridicule each other's incorrigible delusions. They were entering when Oblonsky overtook them, and were talking about the weather. Prince Alexander Dmitrich Shcherbatsky and young Shcherbatsky, Turovtsin, Kitty and Karenin, were already in the drawing-room. Oblonsky noticed at once that without him things were going badly in the drawing-room. His wife, in her gala dress, a grey silk, evidently worried both about the children who would have to dine alone in the nursery and about her husband who had not returned, had not managed in his absence to mix the guests properly. They all sat like a parish priest's wife visiting, as the old Prince Shcherbatsky expressed it, evidently puzzled as to why they were all assembled there and forcing out words in order not to remain silent. The good-natured Turovtsin clearly felt quite out of it, and the smile on his thick lips with which he met Oblonsky said as clearly as words, "Well, my friend, you have planted me among the clever ones. To have a drink at the Chateau des Fleurs would be more in my line." The old prince sat silent, his shining eyes looking askance at Karenin, and Oblonsky saw that he had already prepared some remark wherewith to polish off that dignitary of state whom people were invited to as to a dish of sturgeon. Kitty kept looking toward the door, gathering courage not to blush when Konstantin Levin should enter. Young Shcherbatsky, who had not been introduced to Karenin, tried to look as if this did not make him feel at all awkward. Karenin himself, as the Petersburg way is when one dines with ladies, was in evening dress with a white tie, and Oblonsky saw by his face that he had come only to keep his promise, and by being in that company was fulfilling an unpleasant duty. He was the chief cause of the iciness which had frozen all the visitors till Oblonsky's arrival. On entering the drawing-room, Oblonsky made his excuses, explaining that he had been kept by the particular prince who was his usual scapegoat whenever he was late or absent, and in a moment he had reintroduced everybody, and having brought Karenin and Koznishev together, he started them off on the subject of the Russification of Poland, and they immediately caught on, Pestsov joining them. Having patted Turovtsin on the shoulder, he whispered something funny in his ear and got him to sit down next to Dolly and the old prince. Then he told Kitty that she was looking very nice and introduced young Shcherbatsky to Karenin. In a moment he had kneaded all that society dough in such a way that the drawing-room was in first-rate form and was filled with animated voices. Only Konstantin Levin had not arrived. However, that was all for the best, for Oblonsky, on looking in at the dining-room, saw to his horror that the port wine and sherry were from Desprez and not from Levay, and having given orders to send the coachman as quickly as possible to Levay, he turned to go back to the drawing-room. But he met Levin at the door. "I'm not late."
"As if you could ever help being late," said Oblonsky, taking his hand.
"Are there many people here?"
"Whom have you got?"
asked Levin with a blush, knocking the snow off his cap with his glove.
"All our own people. Oh, Kitty is here. Come, I will introduce you to Karenin."
Oblonsky, in spite of being liberal, knew that to be acquainted with Karenin could not but be an honour, and therefore treated his best friends to that honour. But at that moment Konstantin Levin was not in a state fully to appreciate the pleasure of such an acquaintance.
He had not seen Kitty since the memorable evening when he had met Vronsky, excepting for that one moment when he had caught sight of her on the high road. In the depths of his soul, he had felt sure that he should meet her that evening, but to maintain his freedom of thought, he had tried to assure himself that he did not know it. Now, when he heard that she was here, he was suddenly filled with such joy, and at the same time with such fear, that it took away his breath, and he could not utter what he wished to say. What was she like? The same as before? Or as she was that morning in the carriage? What if Darya Alexandrovna had spoken the truth? Why should it not be true? He thought. Oh, do introduce me to Karenin, he brought out with difficulty. And with despairing determination he entered the drawing-room and saw her. She was not as she had been before, nor as he had seen her in the carriage. She was quite different. She was frightened, shy, shamefaced, and therefore even more charming. She saw him as soon as he entered. She had been waiting for him. She was filled with joy, and that joy made her feel so confused that for a moment when, as he was approaching the hostess, he again glanced at her, Kitty herself, he and Dolly, all thought she would not be able to control herself, but would burst into tears. She blushed again, and quite rigid, with only her lips quivering slightly, sat waiting for him. He came up, bowed, and silently held out his hand. Had it not been for the light quivering of her lips and the moisture that made her eyes brighter, her smile would have appeared almost calm when she said, "What a long time it is since we saw one another." While with a desperate resolve her cold hand pressed his. "You have not seen me, but I saw you," said Lievin with a beaming smile of joy. "I saw you on your way to Ergoshevo from the station." "When?" she asked him with surprise. "You were driving to Ergoshevo," said Lievin, feeling that the happiness with which his heart was overflowing was taking his breath away. How did I dare to connect anything that was not innocent with this pathetic being? Yes, what Darya Alexandrovna told me seems to be true, he thought. Oblonsky took his arm and led him up to Karenin. Let me introduce you, and he gave their names. Very pleased to meet you again, said Karenin coldly as he shook hands with Lievin. Are you acquainted? Asked Oblonsky with surprise. We spent 3 hours together in a railway carriage, said Lievin with a smile. But we parted filled with curiosity, as people do after a masquerade. At any rate, I did.
Dear me, if you please, said Oblonsky, motioning them toward the dining-room.
The men went to the side table in the dining-room, on which stood bottles with 6 kinds of vodka, and plates with as many sorts of cheese, with and without silver cheese-knives, caviar, herrings, different kinds of tinned delicacies, and slices of French rolls. They stood round the scented vodka and the delicacies, and the conversation about the Russification of Poland between Koznishev, Karenin, and Pestsov gradually slackened in the expectation of dinner. Koznishev, who knew better than anyone how at the end of a most abstract and serious dispute unexpectedly to administer a grain of Attic salt, and thereby to change his interlocutor's frame of mind, did so now. Karenin was arguing that the Russification of Poland could only be accomplished by high principles which the Russian administration must introduce. Pestsov insisted that one nation can assimilate another only when the former is more densely populated. Koznishev agreed with both, but with limitations. When they had left the drawing-room, Koznishev, to finish the conversation, remarked with a smile, "Consequently, for the Russification of the alien nationalities, there is but one means, to breed as many children as possible. So my brother and I are acting worst of all, and you married gentlemen, and especially Stepan Arkadyevich, are acting most patriotically." "How many have you got?" he asked, turning to the host with a kindly smile and holding out a tiny wine glass to be filled. Everybody laughed, and Oblonsky most merrily of all.
"Yes, that is the very best way," he said, chewing some cheese and filling the glass with a special kind of vodka. And the conversation was really ended by the joke.
"This cheese is not bad. May I help you to some?" asked the host. "Have you really been doing gymnastics again?" he went on, turning to Lievin, and with his left hand he felt Lievin's muscles. Lievin smiled, tightening his arm, and under Oblonsky's fingers a lump like a Dutch cheese and hard as steel bulged out beneath the fine cloth of Lievin's coat.
"Here's a biceps, a real Samson."
"I expect great strength is needed for bear hunting," said Karenin, who had the vaguest notions about sport, as he helped himself to cheese and broke his slice of bread, cut as fine as a cobweb. Lievin smiled.
"None at all. On the contrary, a child can kill a bear," he said, making room with a slight bow for the ladies who were coming up to the side table with the hostess.
"You have killed a bear, I hear," said Kitty, vainly trying to catch a wayward, slippery, pickled mushroom with her fork, and so shaking the lace of her sleeve through which her arm gleamed white. "Have you any bears near your estate?" she added, turning her lovely little head toward him and smiling. There was, it would seem, nothing unusual in what she had said. But for him, what a meaning there was, inexpressible in words, in every sound and every movement of her lips, her eyes, and her hands as she said it. There was a prayer for forgiveness and trust in him, and a caress, a tender, timid caress, and a promise, and hope, and love for him in which he could not but believe, and which suffocated him with joy. "No, we went to the Tver province. On my return journey, I met your brother-in-law, or rather, your brother-in-law's brother-in-law, on the train," he said, smiling. "It was a funny meeting." And gaily and amusingly, he told how, after not sleeping all night, he, in his sheepskin coat, had rushed into Karenin's compartment. "The guard, regardless of the proverb, judged me by my clothes and wished to turn me out, but I began to use long words, and you too," he went on, turning to Karenin, whose Christian name and patronymic he had forgotten. "Judging me by my peasant coat, were going to turn me out, but afterwards you took my part, for which I am very grateful." "The rights of passengers to a choice of seats are very ill-defined," said Karenin, wiping the tips of his fingers on his handkerchief.
"I noticed that you were not quite sure what to make of me," said Lievin, with a good-natured smile, "so I hastened to start an intellectual conversation to expiate my sheepskin."
Koznishev, while continuing his conversation with the hostess, listened with one ear to his brother, turning his eyes toward him, and thought, "What has happened to him today? He behaves like a conqueror." He did not know that Lievin felt as if he had grown a pair of wings. Lievin knew that she was listening to his words and liked hearing him, and that was the only thing he cared about. Not only in that room, but in the whole world, there existed for him nothing but Kitty and himself, and he had now acquired a great significance and importance. He felt himself at a height that made him giddy, and there, somewhere far below, were all these good, excellent Karenins, Oblonskys, and the rest of the world. Quite casually, without looking at them, and just as if there was no other place to put them, Oblonsky placed Lievin and Kitty side by side.
"Well, you might sit here," he said to Lievin.
The dinner was as good as the dinner service, a thing of which Oblonsky was a connoisseur. The soup, Marie-Louise, had succeeded to perfection. The tiny pasties melted in one's mouth and were flawless. Two footmen and Matvey, wearing white ties, manipulated the food and the wines unostentatiously, quietly, and quickly. The dinner was a success on the material side, and no less so on the non-material side. The conversation, sometimes general and sometimes tête-à-tête, never ceased, and toward the end became so animated that the men left the table without ceasing to talk, and even Karenin was infected.
Chapter 10. Pestsov liked to bring his discussions to a finish,
and had not been satisfied with Koznishev's remark, especially as he felt the fallacy of his own opinion.
"I did not mean," he began over his soup, addressing Karenin, "the density of population alone, but that combined with firm foundations. It is not principles that count."
"It seems to me," replied Karenin, deliberately and languidly, "that it is one and the same thing. In my opinion, only that nation which is more highly developed can influence another. Only that—"
"But the question is," interrupted Pestsov in his deep voice. He was always in a hurry to speak and always seemed to stake his whole soul on what he was talking about. "What does higher development consist of? The English, the French, or the Germans? Which of them is more highly developed? Which will nationalize the other? We see that the Rhine has become Frenchified, yet the Germans do not stand on a lower level," he shouted. "There is some other law."
"I think that the influence will always be on the side of the truly educated," said Karenin, slightly raising his eyebrows.
"But what should we consider to be the signs of true education?" said Pestsov.
"I fancy that those signs are well known," replied Karenin. "Are they fully known?" intervened Koznishev with a subtle smile. "At present, a purely classical education is regarded as the only real education, but we hear lively discussions from both sides and cannot deny that the opposite view has many arguments in its favour."
"You are a classic, Sergei Ivanovich. Have a glass of claret," said Oblonsky.
"I am not expressing my opinion of either kind of education," replied Koznishev, smiling at him condescendingly as at a child and holding out his glass. "All I say is that both sides have weighty arguments in their favour," he continued, addressing himself to Karenin. "I have had a classical education, but can personally find no place in that controversy. I see no clear proofs that a classical education should be preferred to a modern education."
"Natural science has just as great an educational and mind-developing influence," Pestsov joined in. "Take astronomy, or take botany, or zoology with its system of general laws."
"I can't quite agree with you," answered Karenin. "It seems to me that we must admit that the process of studying the forms of a language has in itself a beneficial effect on spiritual development. Besides, it is impossible to deny that the influence of the classics is in the highest degree a moral one, whereas, unfortunately, with instruction in natural science are connected those dangerous and false teachings which are the bane of the present times." Koznishev was going to say something, but Pestsov's deep bass interrupted him. He began with great warmth to prove the falseness of this opinion. Koznishev quietly waited to put in his word, evidently ready with a triumphant retort. "But one cannot help admitting," he said, with his subtle smile, turning to Karenin, "one cannot help admitting that it is difficult to weigh exactly all the pros and cons of the different studies, and that the question which kind of education should be preferred would not have been so easily decided had there not been on the side of classical education that advantage which you have just mentioned. The moral advantage, disons le mot, the anti-nihilistic influence."
"Exactly."
"Were it not for the advantage of this anti-nihilistic influence on the side of classical education, we should have considered the question longer, and should have weighed the arguments on both sides," said Koznishev, subtly smiling. "We should have given a free field to both systems. But now we know that those classical education pills contain the salutary virtue of anti-nihilism, and we offer them boldly to our patients."
"But supposing it has not that salutary virtue after all," he concluded, adding the grain of Attic salt.
Everybody laughed at Koznishev's pills, and Turovtsin, who had at last heard the something funny for which he had been waiting as he listened to the conversation, laughed particularly loudly and merrily. Oblonsky had made no mistake in inviting Pestsov. With Pestsov there, intellectual conversation could not stop for a moment. Hardly had Koznishev with his joke put an end to the discussion of one question before Pestsov immediately raised another.
One cannot even admit that the government had that aim in view, he said. The government is evidently guided by general considerations and is indifferent to the influence its measures may have. For instance, it ought to consider the education of women injurious, yet it established courses of lectures.